Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Recent news out of the Middle East is as complex as ever, with the U.S. pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal and moving its embassy to Jerusalem, setting off a wave of protests, especially of Palestinians in Gaza. Why is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict so intractable? And are there areas of cooperation we can point to that offer a basis for hope? Well, one such bright spot is the Israeli healthcare system, in which Jewish Israelis work alongside Palestinian Arabs, some Muslim, some Christian, for the common good of their patients. And those patients, they come from all sectors of the Israeli-Palestinian divide, Israel proper, also the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, even, as I learned from my guest today, medical tourists from African countries and former Soviet republics. My guest is Alicia Waldman, who is a palliative care doctor at Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago, and author of a terrific new book called This Narrow Space, his memoir of his time as a pediatric oncologist at Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem. Waldman, who grew up in the United States, made Aliyah, or moved to Israel and became a citizen, and wound up both serving in the Israeli Defense Forces and working at Hadassah. After many years, he's returned to practice in the U.S., where he and his wife are raising their two young sons. Alicia Waldman, author of the memoir, This Narrow Space, and a palliative care doctor at Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Alicia Waldman, welcome to Medical Monday. Thank you so much for joining us. Let's start basic and just, you started as a pediatric oncologist and you had a pretty specialized focus on sarcomas. So just tell us a little bit about the kind of cancer in kids you cared for and what kinds of things that you see or used to see.
Sure. So as you indicated, I actually don't practice primary pediatric oncology anymore, but I did for a number of years. And when I did, I focused on the care of kids with sarcomas, which tends to be tumors of muscle, bone, and connective tissue. And I should also state, just so that nobody gets overly sad about it, it surely is sad to hear about kids with cancer. Most kids with cancer do survive treatment. So, you know, there is some happiness in the field. It's not all depressing.
I think, do I remember correctly in the book you said something like 70%?
Yes. Yeah, so actually, if you take all forms of cancer, pediatric cancer bundled together, depending on how you cut those numbers up, it might actually be closer to 80%, 85% even. 70% is if you have a child with just a single focus of a sarcoma, like so a bone tumor in one place that hasn't spread or a muscle tumor that hasn't spread, those kids, depending on subtypes, tend to have a 70%+ chance of survival, which, you know, is not 100, but, you know, is pretty darn good. And, I mean, I'm happy to say that I'm still in touch with a good number of kids and families who have survived treatment years later.
And so you, a few years ago, made this transition, I guess. Well, the first thing is, and what we're going to get to this about your time in Israel, but you wound up doing a fellowship in palliative care. And on this program, we've certainly talked about that and interviewed some local folks. But I guess, tell us about your focus in palliative care at Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. Like what, you know, who you care for and what your goals are.
It's definitely a little different from my past identity as a pediatric oncologist. Pediatric palliative care, again, I should state at the outset, is not just end-of-life care. People often are confused about that. It's true that end-of-life care does fall into our area of expertise, but if you drew a Venn diagram, that would just be a much smaller circle within a much larger blob. We are a specialty that aims to provide support for children and families facing serious, generally life-threatening illness, but regardless of stage or prognosis. And that's sort of a loaded sentence, which has a lot of important components in it. What it boils down to is we do different things for different families, ranging from help thinking about complex symptom management, whether that's pain or sleep or anxiety or constipation. We often help families think about difficult decision-making, whether that's interventions, surgeries, experimental treatments. And finally, we often help families think about what it means to care for a child with complex needs over the long run. And I think that all of those things speak to two of the major differences between pediatric palliative care and adult palliative care. So one of those differences is that most kids nationally who are referred to pediatric palliative care services are kids who have what we would deemed to be complex chronic illness, which is to say they're kids that have neurodegenerative disorders, kids with metabolic and genetic disorders. So the majority of the kids are not kids with cancer, which is also a misperception that many people have. And the other big difference between pediatrics and adult is that if you look at national surveys of pediatric palliative care services, most kids who are referred to palliative care are actually still alive a year after referral, which again speaks to the fact that most of these kids have complex chronic illness, but you know, they may live for months, years, or depending on the disease, even decades.
I'm curious if your, I guess maybe you call them former colleagues in oncology, do they view you as having sort of gone to the other side, or do you feel like there's irreconcilable differences? I mean, obviously you're all on the same team and you're trying to do what's best for the patient, but if you're the oncologist, you're focused on curing the cancer, and sometimes that involves, frankly, harm. I mean, you have to sort of poison the cancer cells or cut them out, whereas in palliative care, you're thinking about symptom management, and so those can conflict.
Right, so they shouldn't conflict. I agree with you. I think that sometimes people come at it from the wrong direction and sort of have this tough guy image of, you know, well, we're going to have to hurt this patient in order to help them. By the way, I think that we have unfairly convinced a lot of the world that some degree of suffering is necessary. And, you know, while it's true, we're generally not great at 100% control of pain and symptoms, I think we could be a lot better than we are, and I think we get away with being less optimal because we've fooled a lot of people into thinking, well, suffering must be part of cancer treatment, and it really doesn't have to be. So this should be my plug for everybody to demand from your excellent oncologists that they go ahead and consult with whoever necessary to make sure you're getting the best symptom management possible.
Well, that's good advice, because I think in many fields of medicine, we brainwashed ourselves into believing a little bit of pain is necessary, you know?
Yeah, I mean, again, I can't sit here and say, oh, you know, I'm 100% perfect at treating pain and symptoms all the time, but I do think we could, as a field, we could do a lot better than we are. And back to your original question, I do think that when I practiced oncology for a number of years before going back to do a palliative care fellowship. And when I first went back to do that fellowship, I certainly had a couple of colleagues who I think viewed that as flaking out, perhaps, or doing something less challenging, which I, you know, let that roll off my back. I think that views have evolved over the last few years. I think that there's an enormous movement right now nationally recognizing that palliative care really does need to be better integrated with oncology care, that we're all partners in this, and there are a number of centers looking at different models of how do you best integrate palliative care. So, for example, not far from either one of our centers, St. Jude is an excellent example of a center with really a first-rate pediatric palliative care group. I mean, world-class, and also world-class oncologists, and they've come up with a system where they managed to get their oncologist to see, I think, just about every oncology patient at least once to sort of get a foot in the door and make sure that they're there when they're needed and that the families are aware of them and comfortable with them. And so there are a number of different models that different centers are playing with to try to figure out how to best do this. But there is an increasing recognition that the two should go hand in hand, and it's not an adversarial relationship.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Alicia Waldman, who is a pediatric palliative care doctor at Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago, which is part of Northwestern Medical Center. And he's the author of the terrific memoir called This Narrow Space, which is a memoir of his time as a pediatric oncologist at Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem. Alicia, you made Aliyah, as the phrase goes, which means you became a citizen of Israel. You were a Jew, and you were raised fairly observant. And apparently you went to Israel many times as a youngster, I think either visiting family or it was part of, I guess, your upbringing. So you thought long and hard about that decision. And tell us what led you to make Aliyah and go to Israel and become a citizen how long you were there.
Yeah, so it might not have been as well thought out a decision as you're making it out to be. I grew up the son of a conservative rabbi and conservative, not politically conservative in the sense of the Jewish conservative movement, which is actually liberal. But we spent, as you said, many, many summers in Israel, and my siblings and I went to Jewish day schools here in the States, and I think it wasn't even that overt. It was just sort of slowly clear throughout our family that we all felt a very strong Zionist affinity to Israel. I should be clear, we also feel a very strong affinity for the United States. My dad often talks about how our family represents the American dream, where his own parents fled the Nazis, and you know, within one generation, we managed to find success in this country. But we all identified very strongly as Zionists, and with the amazing Zionist experiment that has been built in Israel for the last 70 years. And actually, the entire rest of my family, other than my wife and kids, of course, the entire rest of my family live in Israel now. And I don't think it surprised anybody that we all ended up there. It's probably more surprising to people that it didn't quite work out for me and that I ended up back here in the States.
And so when you went to Israel, you moved there, one of the things that you did was you did military service, which is not something necessarily that all Americans who move to Israel do or maybe are obligated to do. But you made a very serious commitment. Tell us about that.
Well, to be fair, I was drafted. The draft age for physicians is a little bit older. I actually think they just shifted it older once again, because there is a dearth of physicians in the military, and they especially love able-bodied physicians with a little bit of clinical experience, because they can, you know, really put you out there. It was a little bit of a surprise to me in that I had expected to be drafted for maybe a couple months of just sort of a basic reserve course, and then do my reserve duty. And it turned out that what they'd wanted to do was to have me do the full medical officer training. And then there was a complicated story. They were going to draft me for a full year after that. And after some negotiation back and forth, they decided that after the medical officer training, they would give me the option of either going in for a full year or going straight into the reserves. And so I ended up going into the reserves because I didn't want to be away from my oncology practice for a full year, especially after 5-6 months of training, which I had to miss my practice for. And I have to say, I mean, actually the reserves are fairly active over there. So I got plenty enough excitement just doing my regular 1 and 2 week deployments with the reserves over the years I was living there.
So as an oncologist, a pediatric oncologist at Hadassah, which is, I think, a pretty well-known hospital in Jerusalem, you had a fair amount of Hebrew and then some very beginning Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the pleasant things, and I think something that, you know, people may not know, is just how, I guess, balanced the medical establishment is in Israel. For one thing, doctors, nurses, people who work in the healthcare system come from all backgrounds. So you have Israeli Jews, Israeli Arabs, Arabs who are Muslim, Arabs who are Christian, working together, you know, side by side. And then, of course, your patients come from all of those places as well. But interestingly, it seems as though Palestinian patients do have greater challenges just, I mean, in terms of getting to the hospital if they're coming from the West Bank, or which I think is also even more difficult now, especially nowadays, the Gaza Strip. But tell us about how that works out. Is it as kind of utopian as I just painted it?
I have to say, to some extent, yes. I mean, it's a pretty amazing thing, and it's I do want to say it's not limited to Hadassah. That's where my experience was. But I believe this is across hospitals in Israel, which open themselves up to patients from the Palestinian Authority and from Gaza. And also there's a significant amount of medical tourism from both Africa and former Soviet states. And I thought that this was one of the most exciting and amazing aspects of working there. I mean, you'd come into work and it was this just like amazing cultural salad of people, both in terms of the staff and the patients. It was a tremendous lesson for me in both cross-cultural humility and also how to practice medicine in a cross-culturally sensitive way. You know, it is true that there are physical challenges for the Palestinians coming in, I think that the hospitals do their best to minimize that, in the sense that once a patient is being treated at a hospital, the hospital provides them with all the letters they need and support to get the passes that they need to go back and forth. It is a little bit challenging for families to get to the point where they get that referral to the Israeli hospital. And I have to say, part of how I got into palliative care was on the other end of the spectrum when it comes to end-of-life care, where often with these kids, you know, we would end up facing these really painful situations where we would have to say to parents of children who were dying, you know, look, there's a choice here. You can either be here in the hospital where we can offer you all of our support and symptom management around end-of-life care, but, you know, your entire larger family can't come here from your home because we can't arrange for passes for everybody. Or you can opt to have your child die at home in their own cultural milieu, in their own bed, surrounded by their larger family, but we can't go to your home to provide support because it's on the other side of the separation barrier. And that's, you know, what a horrendous decision to have to make, you know, really heartbreaking. And we face that a good number of times, so it's quite sad. But I do think, you know, when you ask about utopian, you know, it's not that everybody forgets in the hospital that there's a reality outside the hospital where people are busy shooting at each other and, you know, wanting to kill each other. But I think that there was a real concerted effort on the part of the staff to create a protective bubble around the department. And it was a special place for me to work there.
Well, just to give like a kind of mundane example, you talk about how Palestinian patients or, you know, kids, because you were saying kids, come with a parent or their parents from the West Bank or maybe East Jerusalem, where they do have to cross a security checkpoint. And often if they're coming from further in the West Bank, there was no way they could get there, you know, by like a morning clinic time. So if a kid was going to need, I guess, chemotherapy or something like that, and they arrived in the afternoon, you might just have to admit the kid to hospital because there was no way they were going to just have like outpatient services. And that's right. Just like a mundane example.
Right. So we would, you know, I don't know if we're supposed to acknowledge that this goes on in America, buffing the charts in a way to justify a hospital admission or staying an extra day. You know, we would do that for the patients, of course. The slightly more complex example would be, you know, if we had a kid in between chemotherapy treatments where we knew that their blood counts were low and we knew there was a really high chance they were going to have a fever that night. And you kind of get a feel for it as an oncologist, right? I mean, you're looking at the kid and you just say, this kid doesn't look 100%. You know, you're not going to send that kid home when you know it's going to take them hours and hours to get back in the middle of the night if they have a fever, which is dangerous. You know, the fever itself is dangerous, no less. So, you know, in those sorts of situations, we would either manufacture a fever or make up an excuse of why they had to stay. And, you know, sure enough, they'd get the fever during the night. And, you know, then you felt good about what you did because they had stayed in. But it was interesting to have to sort of rethink some of your management algorithms to adapt to the political realities outside.
One thing that surprised me, I mean, so we just sort of painted this picture a little bit of the utopian ideal of Jews, Arabs, Christians, Muslims working together on the healthcare team and then caring for patients regardless of, you know, ethnicity, religion, et cetera, of origin. But when you had Palestinian patients that would go home or try to arrange follow-up care, it was almost like there was this information void. That is, you didn't really have any kind of relationships with doctors in the West Bank, nor would you ever get kind of follow-up or letters or, you know, it was really just this total void. And I guess the way you explain it in the memoir is that those doctors, I guess, didn't want to be seen as sort of working together with, you know, Israelis. And also there was a little bit of the factor of shame, perhaps, for the patients themselves or their families for seeking care in Israel. I mean, is that how that worked? Is that the idea behind it?
Yeah, it's a little bit opaque to me even now. I mean, the answer is yes. And I was a part of that system, you know, for better or for worse, and a part of the problem. I think that, you know, it's sad and frustrating when you live just a few miles away from another medical center, and because of sort of the political realities, there's a real hesitancy for there to be direct communication. And, you know, I'm hesitant to make blanket statements about, oh, you know, it's because they're all ashamed, or, oh, it's because everybody, you know, nobody wants to talk to each other. I'm sure that it's much more complex and everyone has their own reasons. And I have to say that in the last several years, even since my return to the United States, I've been involved with a project. I have to be a little bit circumspect about it because of some of the players, but I've been involved in a project that has been working on developing pediatric palliative care services at a couple of centers in the Palestinian Authority, and also working on fostering collaboration between those centers and centers in Israel. And it's been an interesting mixed bag because I've witnessed instances where clinicians won't talk to each other because of the politics, and I've sort of been heartened to see that there are some clinicians who are willing to say, look, this is ridiculous. We're talking about kids and health and suffering. Like, you know, let's get on the phone and talk about it. So, you know, you have to kind of try to remain optimistic and keep doing your best and trying to foster relations. But it's a challenging situation, to say the least.
Well, you do write about in the book about one of the kids you cared for in, I think it was East Jerusalem, it might have been the West Bank, but was his name, it was Yassin, or that's what you call him in the book.
Yeah. I obscured most of the facts, but I know what you're talking about. I mean, that's East Jerusalem that we're talking about in that case.
And you pointed out how you're not really able to do house calls, but you I guess made an exception or really pushed to be able to care for this dying young man at home. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's been interesting for me. You know, East Jerusalem is a funny netherworld. I hope that's not too harsh a term. It's, you know, formally it's part of Jerusalem, so it's considered part of Israel, but most of the people who live there, the Palestinians who live there, don't recognize that, and most have not accepted Israeli citizenship, although they receive their services from Israel. So, for example, they're part of the national healthcare system. They get their, you know, garbage and water and electricity and that sort of stuff off the national grid. So it's sort of this weird in-between place. And so ostensibly, there wasn't a problem for me to go do a house call in that particular neighborhood I write about, beyond the fact that the true physical reality was, especially at night, it wasn't completely safe. And in fact, one of the things I write about is, as this young man was dying, I happened to be out of the country at that time, but the nurse who went to care for him was accompanied by border police who didn't want to allow her to go down into the neighborhood alone in the middle of the night. And, you know, I write in the book that people who insist that Jerusalem is unified and that it's, you know, everybody's part of the same capital, that's just not the reality on the ground right now. And reflected in the fact that it's not safe to go in there. Although I have to say that one of the interesting corollaries that I've been experiencing is I've been living in Chicago since last summer, and I'm, you know, becoming aware that there's, you know, it's not just abroad. There are areas here at home that are challenging to go into and to provide appropriate palliative care in. So it's sort of interesting to think about what that means for us in America and in our own society.
Further, you made Aliyah. You went to Israel and became a citizen and worked there. And I can't remember if I think you had a sibling who may have already been there, but then it seems like your parents came after you did. And so, mm-hmm. As you point out earlier, a lot of your whole family, except for your immediate family, is still living there. So I imagine you're still visiting.
Correct.
What led you to come back to the U.S.? Was it just the work opportunity or a combination of many things?
Yeah, it was a combination. Sadly. A combination of a couple things. I mean, when I discuss in the book how I went back to Israel after doing my pediatric palliative care fellowship in Boston to help set up a service in Jerusalem, and as it happened, that was the year that Hadassah faced a major financial crisis and actually declared bankruptcy, and there was a major strike across the entire hospital campus. And at the same time that that was happening, which obviously brought an enormous amount of uncertainty for me, at the same time that was happening, I met the woman who has since become my wife and the mother of my children, and we had an opportunity for a job back in the States, which was clearly going to allow me to progress and grow as a palliative care clinician. And we had to make a tough call of, you know, do you double down and stick it out in Jerusalem and hope that it works out? Or do you sort of take this opportunity to grow as a clinician and grow as a family? And so, you know, I opted for the growth at the moment. And it's worked out wonderfully in pretty much every respect. You know, I've really developed incredibly, I think, as a palliative care clinician here in the States, and I have a role with the big national organization, and I'm involved in all sorts of interesting international projects, and my wife and I very happily have two delicious little boys. But, you know, at the same time, there is a bittersweet element to it where I think very obviously, if you read the book, you know, I wonder about the what ifs. And, you know, I certainly miss Israel and miss the old department and wonder what might have been had I tried to power through.
Well, one of the aspects you write about so beautifully is just identity, you know, the multitude of identities that exist in Israel, but of course your own identity. And, you know, as a Jew, as an American Jew, but then as someone, as an Israeli. And I guess it may not be fair to ask you, but I mean, now that you're living in Chicago and practicing here, I mean, how are you, do you identify as sort of, you know, still as a dual citizen, or like, how do you frame yourself now, if I can ask you that?
Yeah, no, I mean, very much. It's funny. I have a very, I think it's not accidental that it was only after doing a palliative care fellowship that I settled down and started to build a family. I think there, you know, I've imported a lot of the principles of palliative care into my own life, which, you know, palliative care has a lot to do with how do families facing serious illness cope with the grayness of uncertainty. And the truth is, we all deal with grayness of uncertainty in all of our lives, right? Just to different degrees. So I've adopted a very palliative care type approach to my own life and my own identity, which is, you know, yeah, I still very much feel a dual citizen. I have my moments where I feel deeply proud of being an American and contributing to society here, and then I have my moments where I feel, you know, very aware of the Israeli side of me. And even in terms of my identity as a Jew, you know, as my little boys grow and as we develop as a family, you know, we're facing questions, as all growing families of any faith face, you know. How do you want to raise your family? To what degree of observance? You know, how do we think about the Sabbath? How do we think about dietary laws? Those are all things that we're still grappling with on a week-by-week basis. And I think at the end of this book and at the end of and where I am right now, I don't know that I have any greater answers necessarily than when I started. I think that I have a richer appreciation for the depth and beauty and wonder around all of these sorts of issues, and have just gotten more comfortable with, you know, trying to put my arms around it and live with it.
Alicia Waldman, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you very much for having me.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.